There really is no place like home. It's where life happens, where dreams are built, and where you land at the end of every day. But what home looks like is different for everyone. Welcome to Finding Your Way Home, Real Talk on Real Estate. I'm Sherry Doherty, and together we'll explore what finding your way home truly means, whether you're buying your first place, making a move, investing, or choosing a different path altogether. Because home isn't just a place. It's a feeling, it's a choice, and it's personal. Tune in Mondays at 10 a.m. and start finding your way home. Good morning and welcome to Finding Your Way Home, Real Talk on Real Estate. We are recording today for both the radio and for long-term content. And I have a guest in the station with me today, Karen Matthews with us. She's a reoccurring guest and she is an expert in the mortgage market. She's one of the owners of the Mortgage Professionals and a mortgage agent herself. So welcome, Karen. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We're really excited about what we have to share today because this is really important information for City of Kingston and Frontenac residents. Mm-hmm. And we are going to take a really long deep dive into the home ownership support program that is coming open again every year. The City of Kingston mm-hmm. opens this program and it is for support for lower income households to get them into home ownership. And technically, I'm going to let Karen tell all the details, but it is a 20-year interest-free forgivable loan. Mm-hmm. And you can get up to $37,500 to put towards the down payment on the purchase of your first home. Mm-hmm. That's all my buzzwords. The rest is going to be Karen.
So I think this is such a great program. And the surprising thing is not a lot of people know about it.
Right.
It's kind of like a little secret in Kingston. So the City of Kingston has this fabulous down payment program where people who are renting in the City of Kingston or County of Frontenac or first-time home buyers can access, as Sherry said, up to $37,500 towards down payment on a home. Now, there are a lot of criteria you have to meet for this program. But if you meet them, it is an absolutely fabulous way to get yourself kind of on the ladder to be able to buy a home. And it's such a great program that I think it's going to be important to listen today. And if you have any questions, come to Sherry or myself because we can kind of help you get started in the process.
Oh, absolutely. I was just going to jump in and say that the applications became available on March 16th.
Correct.
And you actually have to be ready to submit your application on April 1st. And there's a lot of prep mm-hmm. and a lot of documents you have to prepare, which correct. I am going to hand it back to you for that.
Correct.
But there is a full process. So maybe you could walk us through the process. I know you've helped some people get access to this program in the past. Mm-hmm. And so you can talk about like the technical criteria, the application process, and maybe some stories of some people who've benefited from it.
For sure. So the first thing to note is that it is a first come, first serve on April 1st.
Okay.
So the first applications that get in the door that are complete and accurate and have all their documentation and are approved are the first ones that get into the program.
Okay.
So in order to have it, you have to fill in a completed application, you know, standard things, name, date of birth, social insurance number, address, all of those things. You have to provide, there are income and asset restrictions on this program. So a single applicant cannot make more than $95,000 of income, and a household, as in two or more adults buying in the same family or group, cannot earn more than $130,000 of employment income.
Okay.
They cannot have more than $50,000 of assets. But how those assets are defined, so for example, things like your checking account would count, your savings account would count, your TFSA would count. But if you have money in an RESP, like a kids' education savings program, yep. or RRSPs, those funds don't count.
Okay.
Okay. So there are a few tips and tricks to manage that when I get clients that may be slightly above that threshold to manage sort of how those funds are allocated so that we fit the program criteria. You have to prove all of these things, the application. So you're going to have to provide bank statements and investment statements. You're going to have to provide your tax documents and some of your income documents to show what you make. You're going to have to provide proof that you are a resident of the City of Kingston or okay. County of Frontenac for the program. You also are required to have a pre-approval.
Okay.
You have to have a pre-approval from a bank or regulated financial institution showing that you qualify to buy, because one of the key criteria is the home. You can buy a home that's no more than $500,000
Okay. Right?
So you can buy a home that's no more than $500,000. So you need a pre-approval for a purchase price of up to $500,000. It can be under that, but up to $500,000 with that down payment of $37,500, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I think is really important is you do have to have the savings for your closing costs.
Okay. And I know we talked about this before, but maybe repeat, what do you estimate those at normally for people?
Great question. So most of the time for purchase, we're going to average it and say an estimate of 1.5% of the purchase price. So for a home of up to $500,000, I would say, I mean, the calculation on that is $7,500. I'd say if you had $5,000 to $6,000, you'd cover the bulk of it.
Okay.
And those closing costs, just to give you an idea of what they are legal fees. You have to pay a lawyer to purchase. A home inspection, which, by the way, is required under this program. You
oh,
are
good.
Required to have a home inspection.
Good.
Okay.
You should always.
Absolutely.
Just for the record.
Absolutely. And land transfer taxes. Anytime you buy a property in the province of Ontario, the government is going to charge you a tax. As a first-time homebuyer, you get a rebate towards that of up to $4,000. But if you're purchasing at $500,000, that rebate's not going to fully cover that tax.
Okay.
You're going to have a portion of it owable. And there's a few other sort of costs in there that
well, ultimately you're going to move and you're going to have hookups for heat, hydro, electricity, all those things.
Correct. So you want to show that you have the funds to cover the costs of purchasing as well.
Okay.
Okay. So we've had quite a few clients who benefited from this program. Had a young couple 2 years ago, actually, who met the criteria. We did all the work a month in advance. We had everything ready to go. I don't know what number they were, but they had to have been in the first five that got in there.
Good for them.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he had that email going at 2 a.m. On the day it was open. So they were very lucky to get approved. Now, when you get approved, you have 90 days to purchase a home.
Okay.
It doesn't have to close within those 90 days. When I say close, the home doesn't have to actually be officially purchased within
like
those 90 days.
Transfer of title.
Transfer of title.
Keys,
you actually
hands.
Get the keys. Exactly.
Yeah.
So if you find a home on day 82 and it's closing after the 90 days, that's okay. They actually were a couple that found their home, not quite day 82, but they were 2 months in because they really were searching. And at the time they did it, I think the cap was $440,000, I think, on the purchase price. So they spent some time. They really looked for the home they wanted and put their offer in. It was accepted. We went through the program. The down payment was delivered to their lawyer on closing day. They had their closing
from the
costs.
City.
From the city.
That's wonderful.
Yep.
Okay.
And so now they are very happy in their home. They intend to stay there for quite a long time. But I think that's another criteria of the program that's good for people to know. It's a 20-year interest-free forgivable loan. If you keep the home for 20 years, you don't owe anything.
That's fantastic.
At the end of the 20.
You don't pay the money back.
Correct.
Right.
However, if during the 20 years you sell the home or you do something that is against the program rules. So one of the things would be if you moved out of the home to rent and rented the home out. You cannot turn the home into rental.
Okay.
Or vacation property or an Airbnb or things like that. Then you do have to pay back the loan plus 10% appreciation.
Right. So I was reading in the details that the city does retain some degree of ownership. Is it on title with you?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Their loan is on title.
Is that released from title in year 21?
I will tell you, I haven't yet hit year 21 with any of my clients.
So fair.
My belief of my understanding is they will release their lien after 20 years.
Okay. Yeah,
that is what the program documentation states. So unless you breach one of the rules or sell the property, that's what's going to happen. If you sell the property, you just pay back the loan plus 10% appreciation of the home.
What if the market didn't appreciate?
Good question. I suspect you just owe the loan back.
I imagine too. I'm not sure. Well,
I don't think
first
they're going
of all,
to share
real estate generally always appreciates.
Mm-hmm.
On the long, I'll say like in the long term, there's always an upward and to the right trend
mm-hmm.
over the last 25, 50 years. There may be some peaks and valleys. And so I assume you don't want to sell in the valley anyways. But that would be the only circumstance in a 20-year span where it most likely didn't appreciate. But
correct.
It's curious, and I wonder if that's in the small print.
Yeah, I got to admit, I'm curious to see my clients that are in this program. I think the longest client I've got in this program is 6 years, pre-COVID. There was one client
oh,
I did
good.
Pre-COVID.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think they're 6 years in. So yeah, I don't have anybody yet that's quite there.
Okay.
7 years.
And does it impact at all when you refinance in the 5 years?
Yes and no. That's actually a great question. It does in the sense that essentially the city of Kingston is a mortgage holder.
Yeah.
Right? They're sitting behind your mortgage holder. It is a consideration for some lenders if you were changing lenders. So by refinance, what Sherry means is if you've owned the home for 4 or 5 years, and let's say you want to do a large renovation, you want to redo the kitchen and the bathroom, it's going to cost $60,000. So you're going to go back to the lender and say, hey, can I borrow an additional $60,000? The home has now increased in value.
Right.
So I have some equity there. Can I take $60,000 out of the home value to renovate? The city of Kingston in that case has to agree to be subordinate to that lender. They have to agree to be in second position behind that lender, which, okay, again, traditionally for all the programs the city of Kingston runs where they put a lien on, there are other programs. There's renovation programs for secondary suites and things
there's
like that.
There's a lot of stuff on there. I was on the website, yes, when I was getting this information, and there's a lot of support programs in, yeah, our city. This is fantastic.
There's great programs. There's the Greener Homes program if you're doing energy efficient renovations. So in all of those circumstances where I have worked with clients where the city of Kingston had a lien, they have agreed to subordinate. So it has not been an issue,
okay,
for any of the clients that I've worked with.
Okay, that's great. Now, the program seems fantastic, and I like to look at both sides of everything. Are there any cons? And if so, what are the cons?
The reality is the criteria is tight, right? You have to make just enough money, but not too much money.
Right.
You have to have some money, but not too much money.
Mm-hmm.
So the criteria can be challenging for some clients to meet. Getting pre-approved can be challenging.
Yeah.
You have to have sufficient income according to the program, but not over that. But you can't have I shouldn't say you can't. It is much harder to qualify if you have a significant amount of debt.
Okay.
If you have a car payment that's $1,200 a month and you're a single income family at $95,000, that's eating up a lot of your qualification.
Right.
Okay. Right. So that would be much harder to pre-qualify. So I'd say the criteria themselves make it difficult to qualify.
Right.
Again, that's not a knock on the city. I think this is a great program, but the criteria do make it difficult to qualify. The second piece is some clients don't want to give up the 10% appreciation if they sell.
If it gets you, yeah, into home ownership, even,
yes,
if you ultimately owe the city $37,500,
mm-hmm,
it's not bad, because that would be, if you were paying rent, that's equity you're building for somebody else versus building your own equity and your own asset being the home.
Yep. The other thing, I think there's a restriction, and this one is not clear in the documentation, so I'm going to please take this with a grain of salt,
sure,
because I would actually be interested in talking to the city about it. They do have a line in there that you can't use the funds for renovations, which I understand, but there is a program called Purchase Plus Improvements,
yes,
where you can buy a home and use mortgage funds to renovate. I don't know if that counters the city's program. So I don't know if you could do that program under the city's down payment program. So that is a question I actually have for the city, is whether or not people, because if you found a home that you really loved that was $480,000,
right,
and you wanted to do $20,000 of renovation, so it's still under the $500,000 mark, I don't know if you could do that program alongside this.
And if you're purchasing a single family home under $500,000, it most likely needs renovations.
Yes.
Because that would be a really great price point for a single family home.
Correct.
You can get some fantastic semis and some fantastic townhomes that you could move into for that price.
Mm-hmm.
And then my other curiosity is about condos. So you can absolutely get a condo for under that right now in the city. There's lots for sale.
Correct.
How would condo fees impact this?
So, good question. From the program itself, they wouldn't, but from a qualification standpoint, I often have to clarify with clients, if I pre-qualify you for a $500,000 purchase of a home, that is not a pre-qualification for a $500,000 purchase of a condo.
Right.
Because a home doesn't have condo fees. And condo fees can be anything from $350 a month to $1,000 a month.
Some places in Kingston, almost $2,000.
Yes.
Those are the super luxury buildings, so probably not anybody taking advantage of this program. But just to paint the picture, they can be anywhere up to $2,000.
They can be very high. And so going back to my example of the car loan, where you have an $1,100 a month payment, which is eating into your qualification, if you buy a condo with a $650 a month condo fee, that is eating into your qualification. So I might say to someone, you are pre-qualified to buy a home for up to $500,000. And using an estimate of a $500 a month condo fee, you can buy a condo for $465,000.
Right. Okay.
So the price point at which you can buy a condo is lower, typically, than the price point you can get pre-qualified to buy a house from a mortgage point of view.
Okay. That makes perfect sense. So if you wanted people to remember three specific tips for being successful applying for this program, what would those be?
Get your documents ready early. Go get pre-approved sooner rather than later, because that process can be very quick. But also, if you've got things we got to alter or amend in your application, we got to fix a credit issue or an error on your credit bureau, all of those things can take time. So get your documentation ready, get pre-approved, and do this now.
Right?
Start doing it now, I
should
say.
And Karen won't say it, but I will say for her, you should absolutely visit with and meet with a mortgage agent, preferably Karen, who has been through this program and has the experience working with the city programs.
Yep.
Because there's nuances, as there is with everything. And so you absolutely want to make sure that you're not missing anything. Or, you know, in a lot of circumstances, you forget to submit one paper or you forget to dot one I or cross one T, you can suddenly become ineligible. Mm-hmm. And it's not, like you were saying, like an unlimited pool of money. There is only a certain amount of funds set aside. And once it's used up for all of the successful applicants, then it closes again for the year.
Yes. And it sells out very quickly. Very, very, very
would imagine that it would.
Yeah. So the clients who get their applications in, but after all of it has been allocated, get put on a waiting list. And in some cases, that waiting list does open up if somebody backs out of the program, or maybe they can't find anything, or they're no longer wanting to be part of it, then that can open up. But yes, first come, first serve.
Right. Okay. And interesting, because it is tax season at the same time. So you should have your documents readily available, that you're doing your taxes anyways.
Correct.
Why not apply for an incredible program like this, which is, you know, it's just so much support from the city in the beautiful city that we live in. Mm-hmm. If, does it impact your mortgage rate if they know it's backed at all?
Nope.
No?
Nope.
Okay.
I will say this. Not every mortgage lender accepts this as a form of down payment, but the majority do.
Okay.
So yes, maybe there's some lenders who will say to us, we don't accept that. Not very many though. Most of them now have a comfort with that. The program's been around. They know the city. Now that the city has all these other programs,
right,
they're quite used to the city taking a second position lien. So yeah, so most lenders are comfortable with the program, but not every lender.
Right. If I may, I'd like to switch gears just a little bit while we're on the topic of mortgage rates. And while I have you, I will ask what's on everyone's mind. What is a current average mortgage rate that you're comfortable to share? Mm-hmm. And where do you see it going this year?
So in terms of rates, you have a couple of different buckets, let's call them, of rates. You have insured rates, which are clients who buy with less than 20% down payment, get a CMHC-insured mortgage. They get a mortgage that is essentially backed by the government.
Great.
If they stop paying their mortgage, CMHC, which is a Crown-owned corporation, so essentially I'm going to call it the government, will step in and pay back the lender.
Okay.
So those rates tend to be the best rates you get in the market, because CMHC-backed loans are essentially government-backed loans.
There's no risk.
So if you're a lender, why wouldn't you want to lend to somebody who the government is saying, hey, by the way, if they don't pay, I'll write you a check.
Right.
So those rates are the best rates out there. They're rising right now on the fixed side, but they're sitting sort of, let's say, at or around 4% or so, currently rising, and I'll explain that in a moment. The second bucket, or second and third bucket, are non-CMHC insured loans. So those could be purchases with 20% down or more. Those could be refinances. Those could be renewals where you're switching from one lender to another. And those rates can sit anywhere from sort of low fours to mid fours, depending on where you're at. You also have variable rates.
The difference? Because I'm not 100% sure that fixed versus variable is necessarily common. So if we can go back to basics and just describe the difference, that'd be great.
For sure. So fixed rates, you're guaranteed the rate for the length of the term. You could do a 3-year fixed, and then in that case, for 3 years, you have the rate, you know the rate doesn't change.
It's not changing, which means your payment doesn't change.
Correct.
Perfect.
Rate and payment stay the same.
I can plan for 5 years.
You have cash flow planning, you know what you're doing. 5-year fixed, same thing. Doesn't change. You have a longer time in that case of guaranteed sort of certainty with your rate and your payment. And fixed rates are, they move alongside sort of market bond yields in the market.
Okay.
So I typically say they're controlled by, but they're not controlled by bond yields, but that's the metric banks use. If bond yields are 2, banks might say, I want bond yield plus 2. So I'm going to price it at 4. If bond yields go to 3 and the bank still wants bond yield plus 2, now mortgage rates are 5.
Right.
So when bond yields go up, fixed mortgage rates go up. When bond yields go down, fixed mortgage rates go down.
Okay.
Variable rates, on the other hand, I like to say are controlled by a group of largely men, who who go into a meeting room eight times a year with a bunch of briefcases, and they sit and they discuss inflation and whether or not the Bank of Canada should shift or move the prime rate, whether or not the Bank of Canada, essentially, it's called the overnight rate, but they should essentially move rates up, rates down, or stay the same. They meet eight times a year. And that is the only time typically that variable rates move.
Okay.
Is when the Bank of Canada decides, the governors of the Bank of Canada decide to move it up, to move it down, or keep it the same. So you can argue that variable rates are human controlled.
Okay.
As opposed to like a market dynamic that moves and shifts with a market. And the Bank of Canada's mandate, sole mandate, by the way.
I love this when you talk about this. This is so well explained.
Of the Bank of Canada is inflation. That's it. The U.S. Fed has a mandate, has a couple of different mandates that they have to, okay, we want you to, you know, do inflation, but we also want you to watch housing and jobs and all these other mandates. Bank of Canada says all we care about from the perspective of rates is inflation. If inflation is high, we are going to try and use the only mechanism we have, which is rising rates, to control. So people buy less and inflation comes down. It's slow spending.
Okay.
If inflation is very, very low, and the economy is in great condition, they might just stay. They might just stay where the Bank of Canada rate is because they think we're comfortable there. But if inflation is low and the economy is really struggling, we're in a recession, we're losing jobs, etc., that's when the Bank of Canada will use the mechanism to drop rates to try and push the economy, try and
stimulate spending.
You know, people have more money in their pocket theoretically.
Sorry, now I want to put my hand up. Yeah. I don't know if that works on radio or on video, but I now you're just listening to Sherry and Kara talk. Where would you say we are right now? Recession versus...
We are in a mid-inflation market. So inflation's not bad. It got as high as 8 during the pandemic, and it's hovering just under 3. But there's two things that have happened, and this is why I want to go back to fixed and variable that are impacting. Two things that have happened recently. One is the war, whether or not you call it the war with Iran.
Right.
What is happening with Iran? So that's number one. Number two, what is happening with oil prices, gas prices? So what's happening with Iran shoved bond yields upwards 0.3%. That's a pretty significant move in about 6 days.
Mm-hmm.
Very significant. So what we saw was mortgage rates start to rise. Fixed mortgage rates. Sorry, I'll clarify. Fixed mortgage rates start to rise. At the same time, we saw gas prices sharply push up.
Oh boy, yes.
Now, when gas prices rise, that impacts inflation.
Yes.
Right. Now, the impact is not immediate because the inflation is what we call a lagging indicator. They measure inflation today, but it might not show up in the numbers for 2 months. But we know it's coming.
Right.
We know it's likely that inflation is going to go up. So if you asked everybody a month ago whether or not they thought the Bank of Canada was going to cut rates, keep rates, raise rates in 2026, half of them said stay the same. Half of them said maybe a cut.
Right.
Now, half of them say stay the same. Half of them say maybe a hike.
Okay, interesting.
So things can change very, very rapidly. And things could change a month from now, and it'll be a different view as
well. Well, the
happen.
World is quickly changing.
It's very quickly
you wake
changing.
Up every day and don't know what to expect.
Correct. So fixed rates right now are higher than variable. Variable, I think right now, the Bank of Canada meets on March 18th. Most people expect them to keep rates where they are because we haven't seen inflation shift yet. We haven't seen the numbers shift yet.
Right.
The economy's not doing fantastic.
I heard some really not great
job
employment
numbers.
Statistics today.
Not great.
Which were really not great.
Not great at all. But up until now, we've actually had, ironically, some interestingly halfway decent job numbers. But the economy is not growing.
Right.
And so I'd say the Bank of Canada is kind of torn between they may want to cut rates to stimulate the economy, but they can't if inflation is a concern.
Right. I think we need to go back to one thing that I don't think we finished talking about because we can talk about a lot of things.
Yep.
So if I'm a variable rate holder, we talked about if I'm a fixed rate holder, I know what my payment is going to be for the next 5 years consistently.
Correct.
But if I'm a variable rate holder, my payments can change. And then every so often you get a letter in the mail, because I had one for a while, that said, guess what? Your mortgage payment's going up because the variable rates changed. So can you talk about that in more detail?
Yes. So when the Bank of Canada governors meet that eight times a year, that's when they can shift rates up, shift rates down, or keep them static. And so you as the borrower are vulnerable to those shifts. Now, if they bring the rates down, great. The rate of your mortgage goes down, but your payment does too. And actually, I should clarify. There are what we call static payment variables and changing payment variables. I'm not a huge fan of static payment variables because they hide what's actually happening in your mortgage, positive or negative.
Right.
If rates are going up with a static payment variable, you can end up in a position where you're paying less and less and less principal and more and more and more interest. And for some people post-pandemic, they went backwards on their mortgage.
Ouch.
Their payment did not even cover their interest.
Oh boy.
So the static payment variable, not a huge fan of. The changing payment variable, I think, is a more real view of what's happening in your mortgage. And so if the Bank of Canada raises rates, your rate goes up, your payment goes up.
Okay.
If the Bank of Canada drops rates, your rate goes down, your payment goes down.
Now, let me interject, because this would be like a personal circumstance. Mm-hmm. Say, for example, my mortgage payment is $1,000 a month, mm-hmm. and I'm in a variable rate mortgage, and I get that letter that says your payments are going to drop because the variable rates have dropped. Mm-hmm. I've opted to keep my payment at that $1,000 because I was comfortable and I could budget for it and I was planning for it, which then meant more of my payment was going towards principal.
Correct.
Which is a good thing if you can tolerate that.
Absolutely correct.
Right.
Yeah. In a falling interest rate environment, if you get that letter and your payment's dropping, you absolutely have the option to say, hey, I'm comfortable with where it was.
Right.
And I want to accelerate the pay down of my mortgage. In other words, if my mortgage has 25 years to be paid off and I'm paying more principal, maybe I've just cut 2 years off of that. Maybe now it's only 23 years I got left to pay this mortgage off.
That would be wonderful. Okay. And so I also wanted to go back to, I was thinking while you were talking about qualifying. Mm-hmm. And so are we still doing a stress test?
Yes.
Okay. Can you talk about what a stress test is?
Yes. So when you qualify for a mortgage, let's say the actual rate you're going to pay is 4%. The regulator requires every borrower to qualify as if the rate was 2% higher than what you're actually paying.
Right.
So if your actual rate on your contract is 4, we have to test you, stress test you, if your rate was 6. Could you qualify for that same mortgage if your rate was 6? So when we're looking at the payment you qualify for, we're actually looking at the 6%. 4% is what you're going to pay,
right?
But 6% is what we have to, quote unquote, stress test you on.
Okay.
Now, there's some talk of whether or not the stress test is going to be removed, but before people get way too excited, there's other metrics they will use that will sort of replicate the feeling of the
basically test the same thing.
Yes,
right?
It will be like a loan to income ratio, for example, that will be very similar to what the effect of the stress test was, which is to say we will cap how much you can borrow based on the regulator's fear that if you came up to renewal after your 5-year term, 3-year term, whatever it is of your mortgage, and rates were higher, you would struggle to afford the payment, which is in some areas, I don't think Kingston is getting hit as hard, but there are markets where people bought during the pandemic at extremely low rates.
Yep.
They are now coming up for renewal, and the payment increase on those renewals, they are struggling to afford, because some of those mortgages in Toronto were very, very, very large.
Oh, well, they, you know, and I'm going to use dramatic numbers, but I always talk to my clients and say, like, nothing was natural or healthy during the pandemic, including the insanely low mortgage rates. Mm-hmm. So say you got a mortgage for 1.9% during the pandemic, and it's 5 years later, and now you're renewing at 5.9%. Mm-hmm. That's essentially 3 times more than you were paying 5 years ago. And some people just can't take that, mm-hmm. which is causing part of the flood of inventory on the market right now. So we're very close to being able to officially declare we're in a buyer's market. There's a lot of homes for sale on the market, and they're not moving as quickly as they used to. And this is one of the causes is that so many people, particularly, I'm going to talk about investment properties, because between that increase in the mortgage rate, you can't increase rent correspondingly to make up the difference. So you might be upside down in an investment property.
Yeah. The thing that's I guess, hedging a little bit of that or impacting, the reason I said Kingston maybe is not as heavily impacted as a market like Toronto, is that number one, yes, the rate is much higher, but your principal of your mortgage is also lower though. You've paid, like if you start with a mortgage of $350,000, 5 years in, your mortgage might be $315,000, $310,000. Right. So you're applying a higher rate to a lower balance. The other thing some clients did, at my advice, was they paid accelerated. So they paid their mortgage. They chose to pay a little bit more on every payment. So instead of, let's say, a 25-year pay down of your mortgage, they chose to pay as if it was 22 and a half years. So for some clients who come up to that renewal, we have quite a few options. Number one, their mortgages are much lower than they otherwise would have been.
Okay.
Number two, they can stop or pause the accelerated payment for a time.
Okay.
So I've had clients come up for renewal where their payments have shifted not at all or $100 every 2 weeks. And I'm not saying that's nothing. That is still an increase. Mm-hmm. But not so detrimental that they need to sell, for example, in those examples. So if you're getting the right advice on how to structure your mortgage and how to pay down your mortgage, and then the what we call the payment shock of your renewal,
right.
we've been able to at least somewhat mute that a little bit for our
right.
clients.
That's beautiful. One of the things that I would advise everybody, and I know we're coming in for a landing now, we've got 51 seconds left, is absolutely don't feel like you need to go this alone. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to admit I did for years. I'm guilty of that, you know, mm-hmm. figuring this all out, which we all know nothing of. So get a money team mm-hmm. of professionals around you. I don't do anything anymore until I consult Karen or my financial planner. Mm-hmm. And then we decide what the right move is. And I think we'll have to explore it another time. But, you know, your reflex would be, I come into some money, I should pay down my mortgage, which necessarily isn't correct. So mm-hmm. whenever that happens, I will not do anything until I call my money team and figure out what to do. Closing thoughts just on, you know, the current market, the City of Kingston program, or any advice for navigating this tricky world we're in right now?
I think to your point, let's leave on a positive. Kingston's got some great offers out there in terms of properties. There's some great opportunities. And so I think if you're a buyer, City of Kingston down payment program is fantastic. Get yourself on that list. It can't hurt. And if you're looking, get pre-approved. Get, you know, at least know your numbers so that if the right property comes up and the right price comes up, you're ready.
Right. Absolutely. All right. Well, with that, I thank you again for being a guest, and I wish everyone a wonderful day finding their way home.
He was lured on Grindr by someone claiming to be a 30-year-old man, then violently assaulted in a secluded drainway by a group of teenagers.
You want to be gay?
They're part of a broader pattern of dozens of app-based attacks across the country, driven by extremist ideologies, not just ISIS-inspired, but even more commonly, far-right extremist rhetoric.
Welcome to This Way Up,
the international LGBTQ radio magazine.
I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Lucia Chappell. For half a century, I've produced queer radio alongside Greg Gordon, This Way Out's co-founder and coordinating producer. Today, it's with a heavy heart I must announce that Greg passed away on March 5th. We'll have more to say about that after this week's truncated news wrap. We'll report briefly on stories we may expand on in the future, like Russia's labeling the advocacy group Coming Out an extremist organization, Maryland's $1.5 million payout to homophobic parents, and more news. Then hate criminals in Australia use dating apps to ambush gays.
All that and even more, because you've discovered This Way Out. I'm Marcos Najera.
And I'm Ava Davis.
With an abbreviated edition of News Wrap, a brief look at a few stories in the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 7th, 2026. Russian repression strikes again with the designation of the LGBTQ plus advocacy group Coming Out as an extremist organization. A secret trial held on March 3rd in St. Petersburg granted a request from the Ministry of Justice. No details of the ruling were released. This is the first Russian queer organization to be officially banned since the Supreme Court invented an international LGBT movement to declare extremist. Coming Out's organizers have been operating outside the country since the invasion of Ukraine and say they'll continue to provide services to queer people in country and those trying to flee.
Deviant culture is how a new deputy minister in Malaysian Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim's government wants to refer to LGBT people. Muhammad Rusli is responsible for religious affairs and is ordering the immediate change of terminology in public discourse and in social media. Human rights activists inside and outside Malaysia are condemning the move. Amnesty Malaysia calls it a reckless decision that will further marginalize and endanger LGBT people.
Maryland parents who sued their local school district over LGBTQ-themed storybooks are now $1.5 million richer. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the parents' favor in June 2025, ruling that they had the right to prior consent when such materials would be introduced in the classroom. Damages were awarded by U.S. District Judge Deborah Boardman on February 19th. It's a judgment that puts public schools around the country on notice about potential right-wing pressures.
The International Music, Art, and Cultural Festival, Coldfest, is being targeted by Kyrgyzstan officials based on its alleged promotion of LGBTQ life and drug use. MP Bolot Saganyev spoke out against the event during a meeting of a committee on science, education, innovations, information technologies, culture, sports, and youth affairs. He called for the organizers to be investigated, but a probe already conducted by the Ministry of Internal Affairs found no substance to the accusations. Coldfest's organizers argue that the event is a boon to tourism in Kyrgyzstan, bringing more than 10,000 guests from 30 countries. It's scheduled for July 24th through 26th.
Veteran human rights activist Peter Tatchell is not letting the opening of London's first Chick-fil-A restaurant go without notice. The U.S. fast food chain has a long reputation for its support of homophobic causes, although it now says its charitable giving is focused on education, homelessness, and hunger. Tatchell organized a picket line at the Kingston-upon-Thames location on March 5th. He says that efforts to have a dialogue with Chick-fil-A officials have been rebuffed.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin's legendary LGBTQ bar, This Is It, may be out of business, but its legacy will be felt forever as an official state historic site. This Is It opened in the pre-Stonewall world in August 1968. Sarah Freiheit is a granddaughter of the original owner, June Brain. Freiheit said, "For decades, This Is It was the go-to destination in times of crisis, in times of celebration, in those times when just being with your community was the best possible comfort." The Wisconsin Historical Society approved a state historic marker for the landmark on March 4th.
Meanwhile, the news was not so good for Cardiff's Queer Emporium, what's been called South Wales' most recognizable LGBTQ plus enterprises, announced its closing on March 4th. The Queer Emporium has been a meeting place, creative venue, and community hub since 2021. Escalating operating costs are forcing the shop that's mostly run by trans, intersex, and non-binary workers to close. The team expects to continue at festival pop-ups in Wales and across the UK.
In other news, trans service members being forced out of the US military are pressing the Justice Department to move their case forward before separation proceedings are initiated. US District Judge Ana Reyes has given the government until March 11th to respond to a request to schedule the trial.
Asylum seekers Ludovic Mbak of Cameroon and a woman identified as Farah from Morocco are fighting the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. ICE is threatening to send both back to their anti-LGBTQ countries where their lives are in danger.
British female track and field athletes will now have to pay for their own World Athletics required SRY sex tests. The International Athletic Governing Body used to provide financial aid for the tests intended to prove that the contestants in all female category championships are not trans or intersex. UK Athletics has no hardship fund for financially disadvantaged women.
Menaka Guruswamy could be India's first out MP. Guruswamy was the senior advocate at the Supreme Court of India who argued the case that decriminalized same-gender sexual activity in 2018.
Senegal's National Assembly will be debating Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko's bill that would enhance penalties for LGBTQ organizing and sexual activity on March 11th.
Foster homes in the U.S. no longer have to affirm their support for children's gender identity transitions. The Trump's Health and Human Services Department has rescinded that Biden administration guidance.
And two drag performers from Brisbane have beaten a conservative Christian activist with an appeals court overturning the dismissal of their vilification complaint against him. Johnny Valkyrie and Dwayne Hill perform under the names Queenie and Diamond and sued Lye Shelton over his social media criticism following their drag queen storytime event.
And that's a shortened news wrap. Global Queer News with Attitude for the week ending March 7th, 2026. Some of these stories will be expanded on our next program. Until then, follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Marcos Najera. Stay healthy.
And I'm Ava Davis. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
I'm Brian DeShazer. This Way Out is deeply saddened to share the passing of Greg Gordon, co-founder and longtime coordinating producer of This Way Out. Greg died peacefully in his sleep on May 5th. For decades, Greg Gordon helped bring LGBTQ voices, stories, and culture to radio stations around the world. His work began in the early days of queer community broadcasting in Los Angeles. In 1974, he was part of the Gay Radio Collective at listener-sponsored station KPFK, helping produce IMRU, the oldest LGBTQ-produced radio series in public radio. At a time when queer lives were rarely heard on the public airwaves, those programs created space for LGBTQ people to tell their own stories in their own voices. Friend and longtime collaborator David Hunt remembers that moment as truly groundbreaking. He says, IMRU literally put broadcast tools in the hands of LGBTQ people and provided a platform so we could tell our own stories, sing our own songs, and speak our own truth in our own voices. Greg's vision for independent queer media grew even further in 1988 when he co-founded This Way Out. From the program's launch on April 1st of that year, Greg shepherded the weekly broadcast for nearly four decades, guiding the production of 1,979 programs heard on community and public radio stations across the United States and around the world. For many listeners, especially in the years before the internet, This Way Out was a lifeline. Mark Sophos remembers discovering the program when he was still closeted in the late 1980s. The show soon became essential listening at the New York station he founded, WDFH. Especially during those closeted years, he wrote, This Way Out was a lifeline for me. Community radio stations carried the program for decades. Simon Fresh of KMUD in Northern California recalls the early days when the show arrived by mail. We used to receive a cassette every week, he said. It's impressive how long Greg stuck with this project. I'm grateful. Those who worked with him remember him not only for his dedication to radio, but his warmth. Mark Sophos says that in their many conversations, Greg was so friendly and warm, whether they were discussing the programming or simply catching up. Greg leaves behind a remarkable legacy, nearly half a century of pioneering LGBTQ radio broadcasting, countless stories shared on the air, and generations of listeners and producers who found community through his work. His broadcast legacy is also preserved for future generations through the American Archive of Public Broadcasting, a collaboration between GBH and the Library of Congress. Greg Gordon's voice, vision, and commitment to independent community radio helped shape the sound of LGBTQ broadcasting around the world. He will be deeply missed. Greg is survived by his brother, co-founder, and associate producer of This Way Out, Lucia Chappell, his friends and colleagues. I'm Brian DeShazer for This Way Out. I'm on the verge of vision towards a cup. Caught in the nexus. Reasons I learned to love. Reserve your judgment. Retire your principles. So hold in my breath and don't turn it up. Now I'll be there. Gay dating apps are being used in Australia to lure men into hate crime ambushes. Films of some attacks are showing up on extremist online networks. New federal hate speech laws were rushed through following last year's anti-Semitic Bondi Beach mass shooting. However, those protections do not currently include anti-LGBTIQ plus violence, while the state of New South Wales reports nearly 200 incidents since 2023. Sydney correspondent Michael Brown's report contains depictions of violence that some listeners may find distressing.
A recent investigation by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation has found a rise in serious assaults against gay and bisexual men over the past 2 years. In several cases, victims were lured through dating apps, attacked and filmed. Some of those videos were later circulated in online chat groups sympathetic to Islamic State. The investigation also examined the influence of Sydney-based preacher Wissam Haddad, who has publicly expressed support for extremist interpretations of Islamic ideology. It's important to note that extremist rhetoric does not necessarily reflect the beliefs of the broader Muslim community. Extremism researcher Josh Roos from Deakin University in Melbourne told the ABC that networks connected to Haddad are central to the spate of attacks in Sydney.
The link to Wissam Haddad is very important. This is an individual who has been preaching hate on our streets for many years, very strategically staying on the right side of the law. He has a strong following, amongst whom we've seen many individuals who then gone on to be convicted of violence or linked to Islamic State.
These findings suggest that the attacks are part of a broader pattern of ideologically motivated violence, not isolated incidents. In the ABC investigation, Sydney preacher Wissam Haddad made statements expressing extremist views on homosexuality.
Homosexuality under the Sharia, after being judged with the Quran and the Sunnah by an Islamic judge in an Islamic court, in Islamic lands, is punishable by death.
Extremism researchers note that statements like these have influenced networks connected to attacks against gay and bisexual men across the country. Experts also note that these attacks are not limited to one ideology. Heather Corkhill, legal director at Equality Australia, told SBS News,
they're part of a broader pattern of dozens of app-based attacks across the country, driven by extremist ideologies, not just ISIS-inspired, but even more commonly, far-right extremist rhetoric.
While these attacks are driven by multiple extremist ideologies, the following clip illustrates one incident that the ABC says is an ISIS-inspired video that surfaced online in chat groups. This was obtained by the ABC after it was shared on social media.
Kill him, kill him. You want to be gay? You want to be gay? Yeah?
New South Wales police said they could not identify the attackers or the victim in this clip, according to the ABC. Haddad's centre was ordered closed after it was found to be linked to the Bondi Beach terrorist attacks in December 2025. Another more recent dating app attack, highlighted in the ABC expose, involved a 20-year-old man in Western Sydney. He was lured on Grindr by someone claiming to be a 30-year-old man, then violently assaulted in a secluded drainway by a group of teenagers. After the assault, the attackers stole his phone, he was left helpless, and the attack video was later shared online. The victim was hospitalised with serious facial injuries, including a deviated septum that still causes him breathing problems. Police say the attackers were part of a jihadist network involved in other crimes. One of them, a 17-year-old, pleaded guilty to aggravated robbery but walked free on probation with no conviction recorded, despite being implicated in similar offences. Other perpetrators of similarly motivated crimes have also recently walked free on probation as well. The day after the ABC report aired, New South Wales Premier Chris Minns responded to the allegations.
They're absolutely shocking examples of violent crime in our community directed against individuals because of their sexuality. I've spoken to the Cabinet Office and the Attorney General's Department today about looking at changes to the law to put in massive new penalties specifically to target this abhorrent behaviour.
His comments underscore the seriousness with which his government says it is taking these attacks. On the day of the Sydney Mardi Gras parade, I spoke with members of the LGBTQ plus community and their allies to hear their reactions to the news story.
As a mother of two queer identifying children, I'm of course horrified that this can happen in this city, that I can feel safer in other countries than I feel in this country sometimes. And that makes me very, very sad. Just the fact that it existed, no matter who did it, is a bad thing, is a horrible thing. That's all I can say about
it. Do you believe that the New South Wales government should include LGBTQ people underneath its hate speech laws?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be restricted to religion. It could be restricted to. It shouldn't be restricted to that. It shouldn't be restricted to sex. It shouldn't be restricted to age. It shouldn't. It should apply to this community as well as religious communities.
I think it's shocking, and it brings back some of the violence that's happened to gay men, bisexual men, but also lesbians and other members of our queer community over many years. And it's shocking that it's happening now.
What do you think the New South Wales government's response to that is?
Well, I don't think it's strong enough yet, but by the same token, this whole sort of luring people through apps and things is a relatively new phenomenon, and I think they need to act on it quickly.
What sort of laws do you think should be brought into?
Well, I think there should be draconian penalties, but the app providers should be cooperating with the government and the police.
Yeah. Do you think it's enough just to bring in a very heavy law against it?
No, I think the police have to act on it.
It's a horrible sense of deja vu. Sydney has a long and unhappy history of gay bashings, which the police just wrote them off as death by accident or whatever, suicide. One of them was a young American mathematician who only just completed a PhD, found dead at the base of North Head on the entrance to Sydney Harbour. That crime was written off for years and years and years as suicide. His family never accepted it. It was only a few, couple of years ago that, after many, many inquests, they finally said, no, he was murdered. It seemed to have been getting better with the gay bashings, but it's just a horrible feeling of, oh, God, here we go again.
What do you feel about the religious extremist aspect of this?
Trouble is, it makes all religious people look bad, and not any sort of extremism is to be condemned, and violence is never acceptable, regardless of what you might think. Religious motivation, you might claim, justifies it. It doesn't.
The New South Wales law as it stands does not cover hate speech against LGBTQ people. What do you think the government should be doing now?
Well, absolutely, it should. The legislation should be amended. Absolutely.
So what should Chris Minns, the Premier, actively be doing now?
Well, as Premier of the state, you're in a position of authority. You can't just stand back. You might say he deplores it, but actually get some laws through, get it into Parliament, get it voted on, make it legislation, make it. Don't just say how appalling it is. Well, of course it is, but make it law. Today is Mardi Gras parade, so having spoken about a grim thing like that, we're still here, and we're not going anywhere, so, and we celebrate, and that's exactly what we should be doing.
So my name's Lizzie, I'm the convener of Queer Amnesty here in New South Wales in Sydney. Obviously, we're really concerned about the increasing levels of violence against our community, but equally so, we're concerned that these sort of things are turned by governments and the media into excuses for more Islamophobia, and we don't want any of that. What we'd like is a Human Rights Act. What we'd like is laws that cover targeted violence and hate speech and hate crimes against all minority communities, not just the ones that governments pick and choose. All of us have a right to be safe. All of us have a right to live free from discrimination and violence. And we need a structure in this country to support that, and we need a Human Rights Act.
At the moment, the hate speech laws do not cover the LGBTQ community. What do you think about that?
Look, I think that's a mistake. Like, you know, now that this is this news article has come out, which is terrible. Those experiences are terrible and undoubtedly underreported, under-prosecuted as well. We're not seen as a priority. You know, we're not treated the same as other groups who might have experienced a similar thing. We're not the only group that's ignored in terms of, you know, looking after our safety. What we need are legal structures that build safety, community, and send the message that hate against any group is not okay. Violence against anyone is not okay.
Do you think that'll be enough to stop people committing these sort of crimes?
I think it's where we need to start.
In late February 2025, Equality Australia released a media statement revealing nearly 200 reported incidents of anti-LGBTIQ plus violence in New South Wales since 2023. The offences, including assault, aggravated robbery and affray, often involved teenaged boys, with dozens of cases linked to perpetrators using dating or hookup apps to lure victims. Legal Director Heather Corkhill called the figures likely the tip of the iceberg, noting they didn't include verbal abuse, online hate, or doxing. She warned of a growing online culture radicalising young men and fueling real-world violence. Equality Australia has called for expanded hate speech laws, stronger hate crime penalties to make offences motivated by hatred of sexuality or gender identity more serious, and better reporting, monitoring and victim support, stressing that legal changes alone are not enough to stop this broader pattern of hate. Equality Australia's CEO Anna Brown told the ABC that the rise in hate crimes is not just confined to Sydney alone.
What we've seen in recent months, and indeed over the last couple of years, is a disturbing escalation in hate threats, online attacks, verbal abuse, harassment, and sadly, vandalism and bashings as well. So we've had spates of bashings in Sydney, and in fact parts of across Australia in different states and territories, targeting men using the Grindr app. And we've also seen at its worst these attacks getting with physical threats of violence and bashings in for instance, Wet Reservoir in Melbourne. A couple were attacked with a machete in Rundle Street Mall in Adelaide. A couple holding hands walking along the mall were attacked, and one ended up in hospital with their jaw broken. But it's extremely alarming. And in New South Wales, we have really significant instances as well.
Considering how easy it is to set up a fake profile on a dating app, an article published by the Australian research-based news site The Conversation notes, it's important to emphasise that members of minority communities are not responsible for hate crimes, and that individual precautions can never be completely foolproof. Recent Australian history demonstrates that where discrimination and exclusion of LGBTQ plus people are normalised in public life, offenders are empowered to rationalise and normalise violence. It's yet to be seen how governments, both state and federal, the police and the courts, respond to these latest challenges.
That was Michael Brown reporting from Sydney.